Welcome to the No Film School podcast. My name is Ryan Koo, and today we're going to talk about the collaboration between the cinematographer and the production designer. As a proud sponsor of both the 2016 Sundance Film Festival and the No Film School podcast, Canon USA would like to congratulate and celebrate the filmmakers behind the camera. Canon Cinema EOS, go wherever the story takes you. Sundance is the premier film festival for feature-length independent films, but for short films, it's also My Road Reel, the world's largest short film competition. Presented by Australian film company Rode Microphones, the competition is kicking off for its third year shortly. Register your interest at myroadreel.com. This conversation was recorded at the 2016 Sundance Film Festival. It is with the cinematographer Wolfgang Held and the production designer Darcy Scanlon. They collaborated on the Sundance selection Sophie and the Rising Sun. The film is not out yet, but it just played at the Berlin European Film Market, so stay tuned about when the release date will be. For this podcast, I recommend checking out our associated post at nofilmschool.com because there is a clip of the film available and that makes for an excellent visual reference. We've also included some of the 1913 color photographs that Wolfgang references, and we share the actual email that Wolfgang sent Darcy with his initial thoughts on the film. It's a very seemingly simple email, but it serves as a great real-world example of the stream-of-consciousness thoughts of a very experienced director of photography during his initial approach to the material. And stay tuned for the very end where Wolfgang gives his advice on what else film school. My name is Ryan Koo. I'm the founder of the filmmaking website No Film School, and we're here to talk about the collaboration between the cinematographer and the production designer on a feature film. In this case, the feature Sophie and the Rising Sun, which has premiered here at the 2016 Sundance Film Festival. It is directed by Maggie Greenwald, who you may recognize from other credits like Songcatcher, and it is set in a small fishing village in South Carolina in 1941. In the story, Sophie meets a Japanese man who's new to town, and as you can imagine, in 1941, there are certain events that have a lot to do with Japanese-American relationships. So we are excited to be here today with the director of photography of the film, Wolfgang Held, and the production designer, Darcy Scanlon. Because this is an audio podcast, I'd like everyone to be able to familiarize themselves with your voices, so I will let you guys do a brief intro of yourselves.
Hi, I'm Darcy. I'm the production designer for Sophie and the Rising Sun, and I've been designing sets for about 20 years now, and for theater and opera, and started designing films about 10 years ago. So this is my first time at Sundance, and my first time working with Wolfgang, and it's been a pretty fantastic experience so far, and just really pleased with how the film turned out. It was really a special project to work on, you know. We had an amazing, amazing creative team, and we had an incredible script to work from that was just incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, it was great to work with Darcy. We had really an amazing time with very little money. So my name is Wolfgang Held. I'm a director of photography and a cinematographer. I've been at Sundance, I think, four times over the years. The first film I made with my wife was here in 1994. I've had feature and documentary films, so I shoot both genres, mostly documentaries lately, but I'm here with this feature, Sophie and the Rising Sun, this year. Some of the films that I've worked on that you might have heard of is, well, the most famous one I get the most questions about is Being on the Road with Sacha Baron Cohen or for Bruno, which was a crazy ride, which sort of bridges the world of documentary and fiction. But other films were Metallica, Some Kind of Monster. There's a fiction film called Teeth that was at Sundance a few years ago that became a bit of an underground hit. Well, there's many other films that come up probably in discussions. There's a film with Matt Heineman, who the panelist knows, I've worked with, that was here at Sundance 3 years ago.
And many more documentaries.
Yes.
Me at the Zoo.
Right.
Particle Fever.
Crazy Love. There's a lot of films over the years that I've been lucky enough to be involved in.
Well, thank you all for being here. Before we get into Sophie and the Rising Sun, I'm curious, when was the moment that you knew this was something you wanted to do, and what drew you to being a production designer and a director of photography, respectively?
So I did another film with Maggie Greenwald, the director. We had actually done another film that was called Art of Love during the making of it, and we changed its name to The Last Keepers with Olympia Dukakis and Zoe Mamet. Maggie at the time was already working on Sophie and the Rising Sun, so had known about it. So when she was finally getting the stars aligning to get this film made, so she called me and we worked it out, and it was great to to actually see her make the film. She'd been working on it for 10 years, okay. eight years. Yeah.
And Darcy?
Well, I came on to the project pretty late in the game, actually. You know, read the script and about 1 week later flew to South Carolina. So I had about 5 weeks of prep. So it was just an immediate process of jumping in head first and being totally immersed in a completely new environment, new crew, new project. But I was drawn to the project because the script presents so many delicious opportunities for production design. But I was also just really thrilled with the story and, you know, being about women and all of the political issues that are wrapped up in this film that are relevant today. I just thought it was a really important story to tell right now. It's also just a lovely romance, and I knew it was going to be a beautiful film. I just could tell from the script. You know, after meeting Maggie, we had a Skype interview. She was still in New York, and I was in California. And I could tell that, you know, this was going to be a pretty fantastic collaboration. So it was very sudden.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question, because I myself am a writer-director. My feature film Amateur went through the Sundance Screenwriters Lab. And I have very recently been interviewing production designers. And on some films, the DP comes on first. On others, maybe the production designer. So I wanted to ask you guys about the inception of this project and how the two of you first met and started collaborating, and what that initial conversation was like.
Well, I didn't actually get to meet Wolfgang until we had done at least a week of prep in South Carolina, but we started kind of collaborating over email and, you know, in phone meetings with Maggie. So we started the conversation really early.
Because I knew Maggie from before, I'd been talking to her about the film a little bit, but it happened to start then very, very quickly, and everything was happening. I did a scout, then I was back on another project, and you started the production design much too soon. So I gathered all my thoughts that I'd come up with Maggie in the discussions and wrote an email to you. Mm-hmm. And I think you found that email,
I have the email
that has a lot of these of original ideas.
Yeah, we'd love to hear that, because I'm very nuts and bolts. I want to hear about, you know, it was okay, so it was email, and it was, what was the conversation?
It was a bit of a bullet point. Maybe you can just go down the bullet point, because that brings up a lot of the things that come up early
really
in the discussion.
Does. It was sort of the jumping off point for a lot of the design collaboration in terms of, you know, how we were going to create the spaces for camera and lighting. So, I mean, the first thing you wrote me on the list, that is natural light.
Well, that was just the idea that in the film, actually, I didn't use any lighting in daytime scenes, inside and out, which is very rare. There's maybe two or three scenes where I used the light, and I regret it. Once you have a certain look where you go for a certain way, it's very hard to sneak in a light and not make it look lit. But it does not look unpolished at all. It's just a matter of playing with the light that comes in the rooms and the amazing spaces, and it leads to many other things on the list, like working with.
So I just want to
window
say,
treatment.
You know, in the art department, the production designer is always sort of splitting time between the set where you're shooting and, you know, all of the other sets that you're prepping, of course. I really rarely get to spend very much time on set during the actual shoot. But every time I'd have the treat of actually going to set and see the monitor, I just was flabbergasted with how beautiful the lighting and the photography was. I mean, the color and the light was so sumptuous. I was just blown away every single time. It was always such a treat. And I would say to Maggie, oh my God, that looks so fantastic. And I was like, where are the lights? There's like no movie lights anywhere.
Yeah, and the actors were confused too, because they were waiting for turnarounds and we shoot in the other room.
So Wolf worked some kind of really extraordinary magic with the way that he was able to like reflect natural light using flags and bounces and whatnot out of the windows and into the interiors. And then we would have our practical, you know, period lamps as well. But in terms of, you know, normal movie lights, that it was pretty minimal, and I was just amazed by the painterly quality that he achieved.
And there's a clip of this online, so if you search for it, there's a Riverside scene, which is gorgeous.
And there's a few more screenings here at Sundance.
There's a few more. I was thinking about the podcast listeners, but for those of you here in the room, yes, there's several screenings coming up here in Park City and Salt Lake City.
Can we talk
more about this email?
I'm curious.
Why don't you go down the list? Because I think out of that comes the idea on what you mentioned, the practicals. Practicals are basically the lights that are on set. And that is an early discussion we had, right? About, for me, it's very important to have beautiful practicals that have shades, that have an interesting texture, color, that certainly are of the period, and that I have a whole bunch of them in different heights that I can, for the night shoots, that I can put where I want to light the scene with actually the lights that are the set. So they became very important. They became my movie lights.
Yes,
so.
That was one of the first things we talked about. How, what kind of and how many practicals do we want in the film? And practicals are one of my very, very favorite things in production design because, you know, even if you have sort of a very minimal set, if you have three good practicals in a shot, you can kind of get away with it and make it look good. But because of the period and the sense of place we were creating, we had the opportunity to have a lot of fun with the design of those practicals and using practicals that date from the turn of the century, sort of Victorian, to the 20s, stuff that had a little bit of deco influence. We had practicals that had a bit of an arts and crafts flavor, and also some stuff just sort of from, you know, like 19th century antique sconces and whatnot. And so we were able to do a lot with those practicals and, like Wolf said, you know, different levels. And
but before you even get to that stage, in terms of the initial conversations about setting a look, color palette, texture, is that part of that original email? Were you guys talking about that? Could we maybe hear what that was?
There was kind of an intermediary stage of visual research also before we actually got to the specifics of which styles of lamps we were using. We knew we were going to have a lot of practicals from the beginning. Also, exterior gas lanterns.
Yeah.
And oil lamps with the flames.
Candles, yeah. So candles. Whenever we can, natural light. So in terms of the look, I had an earlier discussion where Maggie and I, we actually stayed away too early on, which you normally do, to come up with a look. And we had a mood board, and she tore some beautiful pictures out. But we didn't say, like in other films, oh, this should be all in the brown, golden palette. But then Maggie came across these amazing photographs from 1913, color photographs, made in the Autochrome Lumiere Brother process, where they use potato starch and come up with these amazing colors where the reds pop, the shadows become slightly cool, green, blue, and infused. And it was a look that we just thought, why don't we try to do that? So we came up with a set of a test shoot, went around the village where we were shooting, the village, McClellan Village, and sent it to a color timer in New York with those pictures we'd found online. They were done in England in 1913. They're quite famous. It's called Christina in Red, if you Google it. They're pretty incredible photographs. And he came up with a look that looked pretty unusual. It had a period look. It helped us with the fact that we're shooting in May, and it was a winter movie, because everybody knows Pearl Harbor, which is in the middle of the movie, happens in the winter of 1941. So we needed to cool down the lush vegetation of the, take out the greens and make the shadows more blue, which reminds you of cold, and the people were dressed up in 80 degree weather. But it worked very well, and that look became sort of the look that I think then we passed on to Darcy, and we had the references, and you saw the test film, and you got a sense of what happened. It was a pretty dramatic look, even though when you see the film, you might not, you fall into it pretty quickly, you forget about it, but it's definitely not just out of the box. It was a look that then we applied to the camera and we used on every single shot. And the test look, and I never had a DIT touching it up in the shoot, so we never color corrected every shot. We had one look that we all agreed on in post. We had different strength of it. We decided on the strongest one of those, and we had it in the camera the whole time, and that's the look that you saw, and then you also could, the wallpapers, the textures of the curtains, the furniture, everything was also slightly altered, and that's when you saw that how that affected the production design.
Yeah, so with the, you know, with the color work that Wolf was doing, I was able to sort of work with that in terms of how we were going to modify our interior sets according to, you know, the psychological dynamic of the scenes and the character, you know, and the history of each place. So we, you know, we also, with the production design, created a very specific color world for each of those interiors. They were really related to character.
Yeah. And then, so there was the blue room up in the sky, which was my favorite.
What's that?
The blue room up in the sky, which is Anne's room. And
so, for instance, Margot Martindale's character, Anne Morrison, who is like the town matriarch who takes in this Japanese man, She loves gardening, and she's also kind of a free spirit and has a little bit of a touch of the bohemian in her. And so we wanted her interiors to feel like the outside was really coming into her spaces. So on the lower story of her house, which was her living room and parlor, you know, the idea was that the garden was coming in to the house. So we did, you know, we did green and lots of plants and lots of sort of organic feeling textures and the textiles and colors of nature. And then upstairs in her bedroom, where we spend a lot of time in the movie, we wanted it to have a little bit of an ethereal feel, but also that quality of the beauty of nature and what is outside coming into her house. And so we did this chinoiserie mural upstairs that was blue with, you know, with basically paintings of trees and birds. And it felt very much like you were in the sky and sort of in the natural world.
And so with these color palettes, Wolfgang, you said you set a look with a colorist in New York beforehand so that you knew that this person was going to be coloring the film.
Yeah, it was done via email. I was already on location and I shot the tests. We had a wonderful woman sit in and we went to all the locations, filmed footage of her walking down, all backlit, all natural light, some handheld, some tripod. We had a lot of decisions based on that test, but the look was based on this test. It was shipped back to New York to Harbor Films, which was a great, Harbor Picture, which is a great post facility. And Roman did a beautiful job coming up with a look, sent back as a LUT.
So you say a look-up table.
A look-up table, LLUT, that we put into the camera that then we saw while we were filming on the monitors, but we didn't fine-tune it. Normally on more established films, you're in a black tent and you're fine-tuning it, but this film was more freewheeling, more handheld, more. I wanted to have a lot of freedom in the film. So we never set up that big monitor. The monitors were all wireless. The director had a wireless monitor. And one of the early bullet points in that email was, I wanted to create 360 shootable sets, which must have given you a heart attack, which means that I can look out of every window, there's no trucks parked, it's dressed for period on a very modest budget picture. That was one of the early things that came up.
It was like, oh, that's a great challenge. You know, it's difficult because of, you know, budgetary and whatever.
Well, but it's also a director's dream. I mean, to have all these light stands normally on a set is so constraining if you want to pan and be agile and make movements. In order to do that with lots of natural light coming in through the windows, what was your approach to hour of the day and the angle of the light and trying to schedule a production around that?
So another bullet point in the movie is that one of the main characters in the film is the garden. It's sort of where all the stories meet, and there's a lot of time spent in the garden. There's different design phases of the garden, so the garden was a very difficult thing, and you can talk more about the logistics of that. But one of the early things in the bullet point is this: I want to shoot the garden facing south. I shoot everything into the sun. It's just the way I do things outside. So I have to build less butterflies and have less diffusion in the air. So shooting into the sun was basically not the direction that the location naturally lend itself. When we first looked at the garden, everybody's looking the other way and I was cringing. No, we're gonna have front light on all the actors all the time. After you big butterflies, it's gonna take time, it's not gonna look as nice. So luckily, you were open to this early bullet point to completely reflip the garden and build hedges towards a modern house and hide things we didn't wanna see so we could shoot into the sun.
Yeah, we were starting from a flat pad of grass that was enormous with modern houses along the perimeter, and we had to create what was essentially a Southern Victorian style garden that then changed throughout the film as it became, you know, as they actually worked on the garden. The garden was a character, had five different phases. It got more and more beautiful up until phase four, and then in phase five it's destroyed. So we had to basically create that from scratch, and that was a challenge, and also was a challenge because we could only use flowers that would grow in the fall, and here we are shooting in the spring, and that was a monumental challenge actually. ended up using a lot of very convincing silk flowers, a mix of silks and real flowers, you know, for flowers that were scripted that we actually couldn't get in the season. We had to either make them by hand or you know, buy silks or just hope that we could come across some little boutique nursery that could provide them.
And then whenever you do have real flowers, we had to like be on schedule to shoot them at the right time, otherwise they would wilt. There's this ending shot of the movie that we tried to get twice.
The flowers would die because it was so hot before, like, but by the time you get the flowers dressed in the garden, between that point when they're dressed and the camera and everything is set up, they would die. They would literally, like, be all beautiful, and then 20 minutes later, they would be all wilted. So that was awesome.
Everyone knows that Murphy's Law applies to independent film more so than anything, except somehow it's always still surprising the ways in which it comes out during the film, the things you don't expect. Like, it's supposed to be in the winter, but it's actually too hot for the flowers, of all things.
All filmmakers, it doesn't matter if they're working on a major motion picture or a small indie, have one thing in common: a desire and a need to bring the images on the big screen to life. For decades, Canon has been committed to developing and engineering the most pristine optics to solve filmmakers' creative and technical challenges, because Canon understands that it all begins with the lens. Learn more at glassfirst.com. With more than 2,000 short films from 89 different countries and close to 500,000 in prizes given away to date, My Road Reel is the world's largest short film competition. Proudly presented by Australian film company Rode Microphones, the competition is kicking off for its third year shortly, which promises to be its biggest yet. There's a huge prize package and an international judging panel of recognized film experts. To find out more, to watch films from previous years, and to register your interest in this year's competition, visit myroadreel.com.
Wolfgang, you've shot on many different formats over your career. Sophie was shot on the Amira, I know, but you also became the recent owner of a Canon C300 Mark II. How do you approach the decision of choosing the shooting format for the particular project?
For all my documentary work, I've been shooting all with a C300 for the last 2 or 3 years, and I've sort of come down with it. I like very small cameras, I mean, relatively speaking, because I come from feature worlds where cameras are very large. So the C300 was the perfect camera, and I stripped it down. I don't put any counterweights. I have the inbuilt camera. I shoot everything with a prime lens. I shoot a lot of very tame, meaning handheld, moving around footage with the cameras for documentaries. And I don't put matte boxes on. I like the flares. I basically have a big Cineprime, a big beautiful lens on it. The Canon Cineprimes I mostly use. I have a couple of sets and a very small camera, and that's the way I like to work for documentary. So I just bought the Mark II and I'm continuing with that, and I travel the world on all these sort of documentary shoots I do. For this film,
I wanted to talk about that because with a background in documentary, obviously you're a very skilled operator. You're also quite tall. So I wanted to hear about that, the configuration that you have with the small camera and how you choreograph movements and approach movement in general.
Well, yeah, so I'm 6'3" when I stand straight, which I don't do very much, but I don't have any rigs. I like the camera small because I go in and out of cars. I have it, you know, hold it on the handle, on the grip. I don't put it on my shoulder, so I don't have a counter rig. So I basically hold it at sort of chest level or wherever. If I shoot with kids a lot, I haven't done a lot of kids' films, I shoot it lower. And I wear sort of a waist pouch, which is sort of like a granny pouch with a little bit of a platform where I put my elbows on, and I rest the whole camera on that, and I get sort of, and I do a lot of slides and leans and moves, and I've gotten pretty good with holding just one camera and walking with people. But the other thing I do is I shoot everything at an f2.0, which is a very shallow depth of field, even documentary. So there's a lot of bleeding of focus when I do that, and this film was shot also, the whole film was shot in one f-stop. I didn't change it once for the whole film, even at night, or even when we had very long lenses, it was always 2.0, and I had an amazing focus puller help me pull that off. And there's a lot of out of focus spaces because of that in the film.
So they have a wireless unit, they're looking at a monitor, and that's how they're pulling focus?
Right, they have a Cinetape on top, but he's a very good guy, Alan Newcomb, who's done some work with Terrence Malick on some of his films, so I was very lucky to have an amazing crew where he could just feel it in the room, and he was almost always spot on. So that normally I don't get to do when I do documentaries. I pull my own. I'm on that little prime lens, or the big one actually, but with no gear on it, and I just run around and I just lock it on, and when I walk with people, I try to hold the distance to the people and not pull focus, and then when I stop, I pull again. So you get a style that works with it, but I just love the look. The movie look in documentaries is always what I love, and then bringing the documentary look in the movies. So those two colliding worlds has always been what makes me most excited.
In a period piece, independent film, natural lighting, shot in a season it's not taking place in. Obviously, there were a lot of challenges. Are there particular challenges of this shoot that you remember that jump out at you, the most challenging day or something like that?
I mean, the garden was definitely, I've already sort of talked about that, but the garden was definitely our biggest challenge in the art department, just because we had to start from zero and build something that looked like it had been there for decades. It was very grown in and organic and beautiful. So, you know, we also had very, very, very limited crew. So I ended up getting my hands pretty dirty doing the that set. And I'm not a gardener. I had just tried to plant some flowers before the film, ironically, and nothing grew. Nothing. So that was the hardest for me.
Well, at least in the film, they don't have to grow long term. You just leave them there for
yeah.
the shoot.
They have to at least, you know, stay alive for like 2 hours.
For me, the most challenging but also the most beautiful day was actually the day at the river, which is the clip that I think you saw where the two of them are walking down the river. There's it comes three times. They're basically the Japanese man and the woman fall in love through painting. They both love to paint, and they happen to paint in the same spot in nature. So there's a couple of scenes there. There's actually four or five scenes which we all had to shoot in one day. So, and it's also the only time we used a jib arm / crane, sort of a high jib arm, to get some other movements and some higher shots into the movie. And also to give a more sensuous feeling for this feeling with this, so fall in love through the painting. And that was a very challenging day because the sun was in and out. It was very remote. We had to finish a lot of scenes with a lot of setups with moving the base of the jib arm around and onto the swamps. We had to go row out to the water to take out buoys so that were not period from the bay way out there. With a limited crew again in a very remote spot. And then at the end of the day, we managed to drive to another dock a few miles away with a crew, did some shots in the boat to get a boat angle of them kissing with the umbrella, which was an angle that I'm very glad we got to, because I think it really seals the scene if you see the movie. But that was the producer was saying, no, we're not going to make it. We were just like the light was falling, and we ran out and got that as well. And then came back and shot the last scenes of Tucker when he's like crowing in the grass. So we had an amazing day of running around, but we made it all in the time with the challenges of the weather in a location with no control mm-hmm. over sun and clouds.
So having gone through so many challenges like that, I guess my last question before we open it up for Q&A would be, with these years of experience, for somebody who wants to do what it is that you do, do you have any advice that you might give a production designer or a DP who's at an earlier stage and starting out?
Sure, I'll go first. Bob Israel, a famous opera designer, said one time that people succeed as set designers primarily because of the rate of attrition. In the beginning phases of working, you know, you feel like you're not quite getting at what you know you can do. You know that there's something in you that's better than the work that you've just produced, and you look at the work that you've just produced and maybe doubt yourself or doubt your abilities, but it just takes some time of actually doing it, and I would say it's just about learning through experience and learning by doing. Just stick with it. Just don't give up, and eventually things will turn around and you'll get there.
Yeah, but for me, it's sort of early on, sort of to really find out what the passion is of what you really love to do. For me, when I look at beautiful images, it's like listening to music, and I still have that, and I always had that. When I go outside here and look at the snow mountains, it's really exciting to me. Certain things of beauty speak to me, or ugliness, or narrative strength. And I think when you have a passion like that, that sort of drives you. So early on, I found a camera. I was hitchhiking around the world when I was 18, and I found a movie camera, and I was just always filming. So that's the way I got started. I never really did the film school way. I went to a film school much later, but I sort of found that passion early on. And I think once you have that passion, you want to be doing it, and you're doing it whether you make money in it or not. And then you keep doing it. And by keep doing it, I think you're eventually going to go where you want to go. I mean, the practical thing to do is, if you don't want to do the whole film school thing, is buy yourself a really good camera early on, which is what I did after film school. I bought a movie, a 60mm camera early on, an Arton, and that gets you the first jobs. I mean, this is a very practical way to get going, because then you might make a little money through the rental, and you can keep doing what you want to do. But you have to make sure you connect to something that you really feel some passion about. Okay?
Thank you. All right, so we have a few minutes. Or we don't? Oh, we have a few minutes for questions, and I will repeat them for the podcast audience. So we have a question from the audience. It's about Wolfgang's decision to shoot the entire film at F2.
So lately I've been shooting a lot on a very open stop. even documentary. So I like that. I see the world that way right now. But for this film, Maggie and I talked about it, and I think she was really into the painterly look. There's painting is sort of part of the story. So a shallow depth of field gives you a painterly background. It's also a practical thing that you don't have to dress the world. You can have a selective focus, so there's some practical ramifications for it. But I think early on, it was part of the manifesto, everything F.2, and I think I was explaining to you, there'll be a lot of out-of-focus spaces. We actually played with out-of-focus a lot in this film, and I find that there's scenes where the character is completely out of focus, and we don't pull focus till they walk all the way into the focus for certain transitions and moments. And I think it in my mind, and in Maggie's mind, I think it helps to bring out sort of the echoes from the past and make it a more internal process of the characters, but also because it's a more modern style of filmmaking, so bring it into the now. So it's a period piece, it's painterly, but it also feels like a very contemporary look with a handheld and the shallow focus. So it brings the past into the present in a beautiful line.
So also this idea of shallow depth of field was really an important thing for the production design, because we had to focus on a lot of detail that was in the foreground and what those objects are and what the style and the exact textures were for everything. And so we were creating, you know, we always were really paying attention to things on a very detailed level, because the camera might be very close to them with sharp focus. And then Wolf would often, you know, frame things in the distance by shooting through these foreground elements. And it created a really interesting layered effect and sort of a little bit of a voyeuristic quality, I would say. I don't know if you agree with that, but because, you know, a lot of the dynamics with the story are people sort of watching others and, you know, seeing what their neighbor is doing and what's she doing now? You know, people were sort of spying on each other in this sense of suspicion and voyeurism, and I think he kind of captured that with the way he was shooting.
Well, one of the early manifesto bullet points that I sent in that email were discover the period, because I know it was a low-budget film. I wanted to avoid establishing shots at all costs, because that's the shot where you spend all your time and money, and you look at it for 2 seconds, it's wide, it feels very, very theatrical. Discovering the period was the idea that we shoot through stuff. So whenever we're approaching the scene with a character, we're shooting through a window out when the bus arrives, so we're mounted on the bus driving into the town. We don't really cut to the town wide. It makes it more contemporary storytelling, but it also helps with not having to show the world. It's more cinematic. Also, with a shallow depth of field, you can choose which actor you're seeing, and sometimes you could counterpoint to the dialogue. You can create a lot of tension that way. And always shooting through foreground. This film has a lot of nature. It's a silent character. So we shot a lot through looking at sun, you know, sort of a little bit that Terrence Malick look of like looking at the moss coming from the trees, looking at the sun through it and racking through against the sun. So there's a lot of those transition shots at the water, reflection of the sun, where you play with that focus and the foreground, always shooting through foreground to get the sense of layers and depth. And
well, we're going to ask you guys for that email. Maybe we can get a chance to publish it at nofilmschool.com, because I think that'd be really interesting to read through at the very inception of this collaboration. I think we have time for another couple of questions. Question from the audience about capturing ugliness in addition to beauty.
Well, for me, it sort of starts with a story. It's going back to a story when I look at ugliness, how to capture ugliness. I mean, ugliness doesn't necessarily, it gives you a reaction, it speaks to you. But to me, when it starts becoming a thing that I feel like I can put into a film, it's when I have a story and characters that I feel I can live in the world, and I see the world through that. What might be ugly to other people, it becomes beautiful to me very often when I look at it. For my documentaries, I shoot a lot in slums in Africa and places all around the world, and there's some of the most amazing places to film in, even though what you're looking at is a lot of trash on the floor and open sewers and things that are very beautiful, but you find things that are very beautiful in there. There's faces, there's counterpoint. But also in fiction, you start seeing the world. If you have a very stark environment, you're in an office environment with fluorescent lights, and you have a character who lives in that sterile environment, you think about something that traditionally is kind of ugly, but you sort of come from the character, and from that character you start seeing the world a little differently, and you find slightly off angles. You think of maybe some Eggleston time photography where you focus on spaces in between. You don't go dead on, but you have like a half office and a half cubicle and a half office hallway in the same shot. Are you trying to break up so the shot in a way to create some sense of cinema and style with that.
That's a really interesting question, because, you know, it's about, you know, what is your own sense of aesthetic? What is your own idea of beauty? And it's different for everyone. And, you know, beauty isn't necessarily something that's polished and glossy or pretty. It might be, you know, one of my favorite photographers is Robert Polidori, and he has, you know, he shoots completely destroyed environments, you know, and, you know, desaturated colors. And I think it's, you know, I totally agree with Wolf that you find beauty in that quote unquote ugliness, just, you know, in terms of visual composition or, you know, light and contrast, chiaroscuro, you can find. I suppose that I'm always looking for beauty, but I find it in very unusual places.
I believe that's all the time we have, and I would like to thank Wolfgang and Darcy for sharing with us.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for listening to the No Film School podcast. We are almost finished with our panels from Sundance. I am personally enjoying these. I think it's a great format for releasing longer form, in-depth interviews. You can listen to it on the go. You don't have to stare at our faces. If you've also enjoyed them, make sure to check out our new show, Indie Film Weekly. And please subscribe in iTunes, Overcast, wherever you may listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.